My dear brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus our Lord, I've enjoyed this week. I hope each and every one of you have as well. I really kind of begged Brother Todd to let me have first period because I counted on every morning I was going to gain a couple extra minutes, and now that I have a couple extra minutes, I really don't need them. Isn't that funny how things work sometimes? All right, let me get this going. All right, we ended up in yesterday's class continuing to speak about this spiritual resurrection of natural Israel. Now, just in case any of the younger Bible students have not fully heard me on this, we are certainly not talking about a literal resurrection from the grave for any of natural Israel. If they were entitled to a literal resurrection, then they would be part of spiritual Israel. So we've been focusing on Ezekiel 34, 36, 37, on the spiritual resurrection and regeneration that natural Israel will go through. And that will be likened to them coming forth out of graves, just as before we come into the truth through baptism, we are dead in trespasses and sins. Israel, natural Israel today, is dead in their trespasses and sins. They are not alive. And those are the connecting points that we're trying to make. I also, yesterday, made a comment that I want to clarify. I made a comment that Chapter 37 was dealing with Clause 22 of the Unamended Statement of Faith, and it's really 21. I'm a very visual person, and I have a distinct image caught in my mind in a recent publication that quoted Proposition 22. So just to correct that, it's Clause 21. And the reason I have been trying to really draw our minds back to the Statement of Faith is because I want you to see and understand what our brethren believed, what they truly believed when they wrote the Statement of Faith, and what the original Christadelphian position was on these issues. Young and old, brother and sister in Christ, if you're having trouble with the position we presented being the original Christadelphian position, just pick up the world's redemption and read the section, The Restoration of Israel, because it's what Brother Williams believed and taught. You know, it's what the original editor of the Christadelphian Advocate believed and taught. It's a good section. I recommend you read through it. But once again, pay close attention to the progression of the Statement of Faith, clauses 20 to 22. That for this purpose, God will send Jesus Christ personally to the earth at the close of the times of the Gentiles, that the kingdom which He will establish will be the kingdom of Israel restored in the territory it formerly occupied, which means they do not occupy it when He comes, formerly occupied, the land bequeathed for an everlasting possession to Abraham and his seed, the Christ, by covenant. Proof text, Ezekiel 37, verse 21 and 22, which is what we're speaking of when we closed class yesterday. And I just want to make sure you see the strong connection between the vision of the two sticks and the dry bones. Both 12, verse 12 and 21 say these visions are regarding the bringing again of the whole house of Israel into their own land. All right, let's go back to where we were, if I can find it, right here. All right, so as we ended yesterday, we were about to say, and this is a repeat comment, but I think it's an important one. These chapters involve Christ's honor. He has earned this right. The people who crucified Him, who rejected Him, who put Him to death, it is His right and His honor alone. I know we're going to help Him, but he's the one that obtained that position to regather his people and spiritually resurrect them. Let's look at Zechariah 13 and 7 again. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith Yahweh of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn my hand upon the little ones. Now, why am I making reference to this? Why am I pointing at this particular verse? It is to focus on the fact that if he was the shepherd, and if this is referring to his crucifixion, it is, awake, O my sword, against my shepherd, against the man that is my fellow, smite the shepherd, that is a reference to his crucifixion, and the sheep will be scattered. If the sheep have been scattered because the shepherd has been smitten, then is it not logical that the sheep cannot be regathered until the shepherd returns? He's been appointed as their shepherd. It's just not logical, brethren, that we'd want to believe that 1948 saw the initial phase of the regathering of the sheep, because the shepherd hasn't returned to do it yet. It's a very significant event. The pre-adventual colonization of Israel was a necessity through Bible prophecy, no question. It is just not the fulfillment of these Bible prophecies we are talking about in Ezekiel's restoration prophecies. And I hope you will follow that point. If 1948 was the beginning of the fulfillment of these prophecies, in particular Ezekiel 37, which we are now looking at, then verses such as Isaiah 11 and 13 would make no sense. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim any longer. You know, there's a real issue that exists today in the land of Israel and those outside of Israel. It appears that, for the most part, people move to Israel that are Jews to become less religious because they really get tired of the formality. And religion is, while there is a religious awakening now happened, for the most part, people that emigrated to Israel did so because they didn't want to go to the synagogue anymore. And that's always been a point of contention between Jews that didn't live within Israel. They didn't feel that their brethren were being spiritual enough. But also in Isaiah 11, another verse that we want to pay attention to there and think about, in this regard, prior to this envy disappearing, because the two sticks are then joined together, the whole house of Israel, verse 10 says, "And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh," and I know Lord's in small capitals there, but it's one of the places the Sophrim changed Yahweh to Adonai, "Yahweh shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people which shall be left from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathros and from Cush and from Elam and from Shinar and from Hamath and from the islands of the sea." That verse doesn't make any sense to us if Zechariah 37 has begun its fulfillment. It just wouldn't fit in the process. Because Ezekiel's clear here, once the process starts, it's not going to be interrupted. Not going to be interrupted. Okay, I think that I've pounded this point home pretty well. but this is just to solidify things. This is to look outside of Ezekiel's testimonies, and for the sake of the tape, I need to describe what's on the overhead. I have really worked hard to get you to see that the phrase, the mountains of Israel, is a significant phrase in Ezekiel's prophecies. It is the place of blessing, right? It is the people of the blessing, because these mountains will hear the word of Yahweh. For those who think Ezekiel 38:8 is limiting as to its scope, there has to be some explaining to do here. After many days thou shalt be visited, in the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many peoples against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. The verse that we are still now speaking about, Ezekiel 37, verse 22, makes clear that the mountains of Israel is the place upon which the one nation and the one king will be set. It is just not logical to limit the mountains of Israel in Ezekiel 38:8 to the northernmost portion of Israel, as some Christadelphians try to do, when here in Ezekiel 37, it's a place of blessing. It is the mountains of Israel. We made the point very firmly throughout our discussions here in the chapter. It is the place of blessing that we get in chapter 34 and verse 14. There shall they lie in a good fold and in a fat pasture, and they shall feed upon the mountains of Israel. Now let's go outside of Ezekiel here. These are all of the verses that I have up here. Well, two of them are very much memory verses, aren't they? And when we think strongly about what is said here, we know that there is a relationship to Ezekiel. And it shall come to pass, says Isaiah 2:2, it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it, and many people shall go and say, come ye, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the Torah and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. All right, that's verses 2 and 3. We know Micah 4, 1 and 2 say very much the same thing. It is a synonymous verse in its teaching. Isaiah 14, verse 25 says that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. 49:13 of Isaiah. Sing, O heavens, and be joyful, O earth, and break forth into singing, O mountains, for Yahweh hath comforted his people, and will have mercy upon his afflicted. But Zion said, Yahweh hath forsaken me, and my Lord hath forgotten me. But that's not going to be the permanent situation. And then Isaiah 52:7, which is a beautiful hymn, isn't it? We sing it often. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. Why is it that we limit our understanding upon the mountains of Israel when we get to Ezekiel 38:8? It just doesn't fit with the rest of the scriptures. Mount Zion is the chief of all the mountains. If you look at this picture that I've got here, topographically, where are the mountains of Israel? They run up and down the middle of the entirety of the nation, do they not? Jerusalem, Mount Zion, right in the middle. This phrase, the mountains of Israel, is extremely important. Ezekiel continues and says in verse 23 of chapter 37, neither will they defile themselves any more. Neither will they defile themselves any more. It is therefore a necessity that we believe that when these two sticks are put together, when these dry bones hear the word of Yahweh, that they are in a condition that they no longer defile themselves. No Christadelphian would suppose that Israel is in a position where they no longer defile themselves. Clearly they do. They are having the same problems in Tel Aviv that we have through the rest of this country. Sexual immorality is rampant. Certainly they're defiling themselves, just like many in this country are. But they will no longer defile themselves. The 23rd verse ends with this statement, so shall they be my people, and I will be their God. They will be my people. I will be their God when the two sticks are put together into one nation. And we know that's how Zechariah closes as well. We read that verse earlier in the week and spent some time upon it. But when they are brought through the fire, when they are refined, when they are tried, they will then call upon Yahweh's name. He will say, it is my people, and they shall say, Yahweh is my God, when they no longer defile themselves. And then very importantly, in conjunction with the fact that the 22nd verse says, one king shall be king to them all, the 24th verse identifies that king as David, my servant. This certainly harkens back to the 34th chapter, where David was said there to rule over them as the chief shepherd. Now, young people, many in our community use this verse in Ezekiel 37:24 to say, okay, Ezekiel 38 and 39 happens after the return of Christ because Jesus returned right here in verse 24. David, their king, rules over them, so Ezekiel 38 and 39 is after the fact. Hopefully, we have laid the groundwork sufficiently that you know that is not the case. Ezekiel 34 showed a depiction of the Lord's return. Ezekiel 35 showed a depiction of the Lord's return in the defeat of Edom. Ezekiel 36 showed that depiction of the Lord's return in Israel's conversion. Ezekiel 37 is showing it. These parallels are all showing us the same. These chapters are showing us all the same parallel time frame. They're not chronological. They are different views of the same event. And it will continue into chapter 38, which I know I'm not going to say a great deal about today. They are parallel views of the same event. But the verse says, David, my servant, shall be king over them. They shall have one shepherd. That takes us back to Ezekiel 34. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. And they shall dwell in the land that I have given unto Jacob my servant, wherein your fathers have dwelt. And they shall dwell therein, even they and their children and their children's children forever. And my servant David shall be their prince for the Olam, forever, for the age, for the Olam. I think the indication that we get in that 25th verse, if you will, the land that I have given unto Jacob my servant, points us forward to a time that Jacob himself will be there. What a great day that will be. 1 Corinthians 15:28, referring to this period of the Olam, And when all these things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all. This kingdom age will be a glorious time frame, the kingdom of Israel upon earth, and it will have a purpose. It will have a purpose. It will certainly spread Yahweh's fame from each end of the earth to the other. It will assist in all Gentiles understanding the truth. And really, what a beautiful time period at the beginning of this time, the beginning of the kingdom. For I suggest to you that after the everlasting gospel proclamation goes forth and Babylon the Great is destroyed, in the initial phases of the kingdom, there will not be one human being upon the face of this earth that does not believe the truth. All others will have been done away. Now, we know throughout the millennium, Gentiles will begin to return to sin. But isn't that a great period for us to look forward to? And Israel will be chief amongst these converted peoples. Finally, the chapter also continues and concludes in the 26th and the 27th verses, stating, "Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them, and I will place them and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in the midst of them forevermore. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Yea, I will be their God. They shall be my people. And the heathen shall know that I, Yahweh, do sanctify Israel when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore." These verses conclude, if you will, as an introduction to chapters 40 through 48. Just as when we get to the end of 39, it will lead us to that time period as well. What a great time period, a great event. The sanctuary, the temple, will be in the midst of them. Yahweh himself, if you will, through the personage of his Son and the saints, will also tabernacle with men, as the prophecy states. Joel chapter 2, verse 27, "And ye shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am Yahweh your God, and none else, and my people shall never be ashamed." Zechariah 2, verse 11. "And many nations shall be joined to Yahweh in that day, and shall be my people, and I will dwell in the midst of thee. And thou shalt know that Yahweh of hosts hath sent me unto thee." In chapter 14 of Zechariah, in the 9th verse, and I think this is a real interesting verse to make sure we all turn up together. There's a point that I like to make about it that I think is quite interesting. All right, Zechariah 14:9, and maybe I'm going to back up to verse 8 for some context. "It shall be that in that day that living waters shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be. And Yahweh shall be king over all the earth in that day. There shall be one Yahweh, and his name one." Now, from our youth, those of you raised in Christadelphians, have we not already been taught that there's one Lord, right? That God is one? We already know that. So what is this verse really taking us to? What's the implication truly of this verse that there is one Yahweh and his name one? He's already one. But the verse is pointing us to a time to where truly his name is one, in that his glory will be fulfilled throughout all the earth. Numbers 14:21, right? Habakkuk 2:14. As truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of Yahweh, right? He will be one. His name will be one. His name will be possessed by a great immortal host and by a people who are covenanted to him and who will be beginning their probationary walks in the kingdom age. And Israel will be chief among them all in that time frame as far as the Gentiles and the mortals are concerned. Okay, let's try to bring things to a close to where we are at this point. Now, I'm confused a little bit right now at what time I'm supposed to stop. Right at 10? I'm not used to being in such a position where I've got more time to say than I have material. This is unusual for me. We'll get through it. I'll take my time. Okay, here we are to the chart now. So we started with the restoration prophecies at chapter 33. One of the things that I did not mention there is, you know, Ezekiel's proclaimed as this watchman again in chapter 33 after word comes from Jerusalem that the city has fallen. So all these words that Ezekiel is writing after chapter 33 are very personal to him. He knows that the city's fallen. He knows he's not going to, in his lifetime, return to Jerusalem. He knows that these are prophecies that point to a great day where he will be able to return to Jerusalem. He understands that they are prophetic of a time that are going to involve a period of time in which he will be dead and resurrected. But just to solidify the point that we've been making, that these chapters are all very much telescopic, like the apocalypse is. You know, you see those charts where we have, you know, the seals. The trumpets, vials. I'm afraid that I just, seals, trumpet, vials. You know, that telescope that goes through here. These chapters are very much the same way. Chapter 34 clearly brought us to the kingdom age when David the prince appears. Chapter 34 got us there as well because the Gentiles are said to have known that when Edom is destroyed, they shall know that I am Yahweh. They will know it. Chapter 36 brought Israel to being a holy flock. And now here at the conclusion of chapter 37, David, my servant, shall be king over them. And I think this chart is an excellent one to put in your Bible or, you know, chart something out like it for yourself. Make something up. I borrowed the model of this from the Bible magazine and changed some things around to fit my own way of thinking. All right, in the time that we have left, and when I originally planned this class, I said, well, I better put some notes together, chapter 38 and 39. I'm never going to get there, but let's put a few things together. And I think what I'd like to do, because almost everyone in the room was here for the fall gathering last year, and you heard the series of talks that I gave and then Brother Tom Northey gave. So we won't go into the same type of detail, but I'd like to answer maybe some objections in the short time that we have left about this chapter. Let's talk about some points that people tend to pick out and view differently and see if we can't deal with those. I like this particular chart that is up here. Those areas that are in the reddish color, I'm sure there's a more technical definition for that color, are those of the Gogian host, the Northern Confederacy. Those areas in the green color are those areas which will initially, at the invasion of Gog, be under the Tarshish powers and those aligned with Israel. One of the things that I think is really interesting to speak about here and to discuss is when you look at a map such as this, And when you think about Nebuchadnezzar's image, it makes it very clear to us that Nebuchadnezzar's image does not stand until Gog can himself incorporate the green territories into his own dominion, right? And I think it expresses an importance to us and young Bible students. You might want to pay note and attention to this. Those of you particularly that are about ready to go through exposition of Daniel, why is it that Daniel gives us the impression that the king of the north is in such a hurry to get to Egypt and then comes back to plant his holy tabernacles within, you know, Israel? Well, we could speculate on a lot of reasons why that is, but whatever it is that causes Gog or the king of the north to do that, the very important thing is it will make sure that he gets into Egypt and incorporates all of the territory of Nebuchadnezzar's image under his dominion is a critical aspect. All right, so let's talk about some facts of the Gogian invasion that sometimes are argued. In chapter 38, one of the things that sometimes people pick about, maybe I need to be careful of my language, I don't want to sound as if I really think brethren are being petty. Points of dispute. All right. Verse 2, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech, Tubal, and prophesy against him. Now, you've sat through enough classes, young people, that you know that the Hebrew word for chief prince here is Rosh, the prince of Rosh. And we've always identified that with Russia. And you've heard a lot of talks where a lot of historians have been consulted, in which people like Jesenius refer to the fact that Rosh is undoubtedly the name of the Russians. That's how Jesenius terms it. Undoubtedly the Russians who are mentioned by Byzantine writers of the 10th century by this name. But some people go, whoa, whoa, wait a second. This Hebrew word here, Rosh, is just a word that refers to the back of the head or the head. And there's a lot of places throughout Scripture where it's just translated as the head. Well, how we would answer that is just use basic rules of grammar. When we read the second verse, is it not clear that the term Rosh is being used as a proper noun? This is the head of Meshech and Tubal, right? Just basic grammar. So we can easily overcome that particular objection to some in our Christadelphian community who want to say that Russia is not even involved here in the prophecy. There is a coalition described in Ezekiel 38 that we would equate with Daniel chapter 11. Those of us in this room, we've read it in El Pasisro, we've read it in the exposition of Daniel, but there are some in our community that say, well, Daniel 11 began to be fulfilled with the invasion of the Turks in the 16th century, 15, 16, 17, and it ended in 1917. Well, young people, brothers and sisters, the time of the end didn't begin in 1516. I mean, that really wouldn't even make a great deal of sense to us. We know that the time of the end can be a period that refers to a number of years, but 450 years? That just doesn't seem logical, does it? When we look at these phrases in Daniel and how they're used in Daniel 11, and Adam, this is for you. Adam wanted me to cover this a little bit more the other day, and I didn't. Daniel 11, verse 40. All right? And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. There's three parties here in this verse, young people. There is the king of the south, there is the king of the north, and there is a party which is simply identified by the pronoun him. There's not two parties, there are three parties. In the 36th verse of the chapter, Daniel 11 goes through and constantly talks about the king of the north versus the king of the south, king of the north versus the king of the south, and vice versa. But in chapter 36, all of a sudden we have a new pronoun that is introduced to us. It's the king. And it's indicative of a time frame when Rome came into play and began to rule over these territories, and no longer was it the Seleucid Empire versus the Ptolemaic Empire. And Rome ruled as the king. Byzantium became its own entity, if you will, which was no longer described by the king of the north power within chapter 11. So by the time we get to chapter 40, we have the king of the south pushing at the helm, the king in Constantinople, all right? And Brother Thomas felt that that event took place in 1820 when Egypt began to push against the Turk. There are many capable writers in Christadelphia who suggest that 1917 might point to the king of the south pushing at the helm in World War I, when the Turks were pushed all the way back into the borders of Turkey, and I think that is a valid thought. But up until that colon, nothing has yet been fulfilled. But the phrase, the time of the end here, is very important that you get right, and that you're able then to look at Ezekiel 38 and know that the time periods are indeed similar between the two. Because Ezekiel 38 verse 8 tells us that Gog comes in the latter years, the king of the north, and Daniel comes in the time of the end. Now, what is a signal event of the time of the end in Daniel's prophecy? Well, I like drawing lines in my Bible. I don't do it in big, thick markers, but I draw lines in my Bible all the time. Now, your verses may be on different pages, but if you've got an Oxford edition of the King James Version, you could think about doing what I've done. I've drawn a line from verse 40 in chapter 11 over to the right and down to chapter 12 and verse 4, and I've connected those two thoughts because I think it helps us to understand when the time period of the time of the end is. So, Daniel 12, verse 1, "At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to the same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that is found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and the seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." One of the signal events, then, of the period of the time of the end that we need to equate to be contemporary with the invasion of the king of the north power, or Gog, is the resurrection. Was the resurrection of the saints to immortality equated to 1517? Was it contemporary with that time period? No. So we need to understand when this time of the end period refers to. Very much so. Ezekiel 38 and Daniel 11 describe the same coalition. Now, recently, I've had a lot of talks that kind of surprised me, and I now realize that it's something that is being given in exhortations more and more, because I've gone on to a certain few places and I've listened to the thought and been surprised about it. All right, Ezekiel 38:4, speaking of Gog, says, "I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine armies, and horses, and horsemen, and all of them clothed in all sorts of armor." I've been somewhat surprised that there are some who say that this verse is describing the fact that Gog only gets to the mountains of Israel and they're going to be turned back. And I think that I just don't get it. But make sure that if you hear that thought, which I've heard more and more from a couple of our Christadelphian writers, that you understand that what's being described in this fourth verse is how Gog is going to come into the land, not how they're going to be expelled from it. And this really puts this verse in harmony with us with Daniel 11. The king of the north makes a beeline to get into Egypt. And then tidings out of the east and the north cause him to turn from Egypt. I will turn thee back and come back into Israel and put their tabernacles within the most holy mountain. The turn thee back brings them into the land of Israel, not away from it. The mountains of Israel includes Mount Zion. I think I've covered that sufficiently. We often hear that verse 9 of the chapter just speaks of Gog's intent and not the reality of the situation. Verses 8 and 9 together. After many days thou shalt be visited in the latter years. Thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword. This is speaking not of Ezekiel 34, 36, and 37 here in the verse. This is speaking of the pre-eventual colonization not performed by Christ and the saints. I will bring thee back from the sword, and is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm, and thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. They will be successful in covering the land like this cloud. And hopefully you've seen some proofs of this. Earlier in the restoration prophecies, as we were speaking about this subject, hopefully you made a Bible note about this and thought about it and recalled it. But Ezekiel referred to this time period early for us in Ezekiel 34:12, that when it's time to scatter the lost sheep, that it will be done in the cloudy and dark day. That helps us to understand what Gog does. Gog further scatters the sheep, that they may have to be regathered even more so in the cloudy and in the dark day. Daniel 11, verse 40, describes the king of the north coming as a whirlwind. You don't get a whirlwind or swirling clouds without the same cloudy and dark day, right? We can see the time periods then coincide. There are those in the brotherhood who insist to us that Gog's intention is to try to take a spoil, but they're not successful. That's the thought you hear sometimes. You may read these thoughts, but it's very important. Well, let's cover this thought. It really doesn't matter how far I get in answering these objections. I see I got 6 minutes, but verse 13 of Ezekiel 38, we see Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish saying to Gog, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" And some people say, well, this is just Gog's intention, but they're not successful. They stop at the northernmost borders of the mountains of Israel, and that's all the far they get. But that's not something that can be proven by the rest of the prophecy. In chapter 39, in verse 10, what is it that is said that Israel is going to do to Gog? What is it that Israel will do to Gog? It is the same thing that Gog did to them. So Ezekiel 39:10 says, "So that they shall take no wood out of the field, neither cut down any of the forest, for they shall burn the weapons with fire, and they shall spoil those that spoiled them, and rob those that robbed them, saith Adonai Yahweh." Israel cannot spoil Gog except that they had been spoiled by Gog. Otherwise, the verse just makes no sense to us. Remember in chapter 34, verse 22, we dealt with this concept as well. I will save my flock. They shall no more be a prey. Make no mistake, young people. Israel will be spoiled by Gog. And then Israel will turn and spoil Gog after they have been defeated. This is also consistent with Zechariah 14 in verse 2, where it says to Israel, to Jerusalem particularly, I will divide the spoil in the midst of thee. It's very important that you know and understand that it's not until after Gog is defeated that Israel knows Yahweh. Remember when we started off this class, I made a big point to you that the theme of Ezekiel is, then shall they know Yahweh. In the restoration prophecies, it's used 15 times, then shall they know Yahweh. Nine times of Israel, nine times of the Gentiles, six times of Israel. Okay? So when we get to chapter 39 and verse 7, let's start to go through this. Israel does not know Yahweh until Gog's defeat. Israel, Ezekiel 39:7. So will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel when Gog is defeated. And I will not let them pollute my holy name anymore. And the heathen shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. Verse 22. So the house of Israel shall know that I am Yahweh their God from that day and forward. Now, if we've placed so much emphasis in chapters 34, 36, and 37, that those chapters bring us to a conclusive time where Israel knows their God, it is simple reading here, isn't it? Verse 22, after Gog is dead and buried, which takes place in the earlier verses before 22, from that day and forward, they will know that I am Yahweh their God. Verse 28, then shall they know that I am Yahweh their God, which caused them to be led into captivity among the heathen. I want to talk about maybe one more thought and we'll close on it because I've got 2 minutes. One of the biggest objections that is sometimes given about Ezekiel 38, and hopefully you paid a great deal of attention when I went through chapter 36 and you've already found a great Bible marking note here and you won't be any longer confused by the differences of opinion on this verse. Ezekiel 38:8 tells us that Gog comes into the land when Israel dwells safely, all of them. There are a large number of Christadelphians that believe the only way that Gog can dwell safely is if that Israel can dwell safely is if Christ is in the land. And they are convinced then that, see, Jesus is in the land. They dwell safely. But the Hebrew word betach here, and I know I didn't pronounce that perfectly, the Hebrew word betach is not a word that requires Christ be in the land. First of all, we made note of the fact that Gog comes down when they dwell safely and when Israel dwells in unwalled villages. Remember that previously in chapter 36, we found that when Israel is under the protection of Christ, that it said very specifically in 36:35 that their cities will be fenced and inhabited. That's the first point. The second point we're going to make is if Betach is something that can only happen under Christ's protection, then why is it that in chapter 39 and verse 6 that Gog once dwelt in the same condition? And I will send a fire on Magog and among them that dwell Betach in the isles. Same word as safely in Ezekiel 38. It's the same word. So if that word requires Christ be in the land, then he must have been helping Gog out too, and he caused them to dwell carelessly. Doesn't make any sense, does it? That wouldn't make any sense. In Genesis 34 and 25, when the sons of Jacob were upset at the treatment of their sister, they went forth, in Ezekiel 34, 25, and they slew Hamor and all of his host. And how did they do it? They did so, and it came to pass on the third day when they were sore that the two sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. The word there for boldly is the same word, Betach. There's been a lot of wickedness that has been done in this situation of Betach. It's not a word that has to refer to the dwelling of Christ in the land. What I've got on the overhead, Isaiah 47:8, Zephaniah 2:15, are a couple of more good references. Ezekiel chapter 30 and verse 9, and I think my time is... Oh, thanks. Is out. Ezekiel 39, in that day shall the messengers go forth from me in the ships to make the careless Ethiopians afraid. The word careless there is Betach also. There's just no way that word can exclusively refer to Christ has to be in the land. All right, I'm going to put up this chart and then I'm done. Just so that you can see, I'll leave this up here until Brother Lou wants to come up and take the podium. But you can see that Ezekiel's 38 and 39 also bring us to the same time period as the previous chapters. And hopefully you can download this chart. Brother Larry's going to put it on the website. Maybe you might want to print this off and turn it into a Bible insert or make your own, because I think it's really informative to have this kind of charting on the prophecies of the restoration. Thank you.